So, Elena, please introduce yourself to the podcast.
Hi, everyone. My name is Elena Hadikerhoff, and I'm an intuitive life and business coach for highly sensitive people. And I'm so glad to be here with you, Kirk.
Yeah. So I get a lot of questions about highly sensitive people. In fact, I was just talking about it with some of my supervisees yesterday. What could you tell us about highly sensitive people?
Being a highly sensitive person is essentially a personality trait. It's genetic, so it's not something you can opt in or opt out of. And it was a term that was created by Dr. Elaine Aron. She is one of the key researchers when it comes to highly sensitive people. And she said highly sensitive people can be identified by four main characteristics. And she used the acronym DOES to help people understand if they are indeed highly sensitive or not. So if you want, maybe I can just share briefly what DOES stands for. So the D stands for depth of processing. So HSPs are the deep thinkers. So they can take any type of information and sit with it for much longer than the average person would. So it's really chewing things over. And even an HSP like myself is not necessarily aware that they're doing that. But we take in our environment, we take in what other people say to us, and it just takes us a lot of time to process and sift through what we see, what we hear, what we feel. So this is the first part of that trait, and this is probably the most pronounced part of that trait, I would say. And then the next one is O, and that stands for overstimulation. So because highly sensitive people have this ability to process the most minute details in great depth, what happens is that overwhelm is an HSP's best friend, because it's like having 20 tabs open in your computer at any given time. And so you can have like a computer meltdown, or you can have a brain meltdown with just too many things going on in one go. So most HSPs will report that they feel easily overstimulated or overwhelmed simply because we take in so much information. And then the E stands for empathy. And this is probably my personal favorite part of the sensitive trait, is that we are very good at feeling other people's feelings. We're very attuned, intuitive. And so this is, I feel, probably the part that most HSPs enjoy the most. Some of the other parts can be a bit more dicey, but this is definitely something that most HSPs will identify with. And then lastly, it's our sensitivity to subtleties. So we're the type of people that can go into a room and say, ooh, that painting is just a little bit off, or we can feel if the energy in a room is not quite right, or we can pick up on just sounds or smells that other people would notice. Like, I had this funny example. I stayed in a hotel room with a friend of mine, and I walked in and I was like, oh my God, somebody smoked here. And they were like, I don't smell anything. It's a non-smoking room. I'm like, no, but I can still smell this. So it's this ability to almost tune into things that most people would not see or notice or even care to mention. So these are the four key markers of this personality trait.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So DOES, D-O-E-S. So let's go through these a little bit more in depth, if you will. So
sure.
I've talked with other experts before about this and thought that I might qualify as well. So one of the things that I remember from those previous conversations was that I'm really sensitive to a certain kind of clothing. And
oh, yes.
Since I was a young child, I can't stand wearing wool, and I frequently will have to cut out tags from my shirts because I just can't stop thinking about the fact I can feel the tag. Or another thing is I'm wearing a watch right now, but I can only wear this watch for probably, I don't know, like an hour before I have to take it off. And I can wear my wedding ring pretty comfortably, but anything other than that, like a necklace or even a hat. Also, anyone in my class as a professor will attest to whenever I start to teach, I take off my shoes because I can't stand shoes being on my feet. I don't like the feeling of it. And is that indicative of a highly sensitive person, potentially?
You're my people, Kirk. I've experienced all of these things myself and still do. And it's what my father always jokingly called the princess on the pea syndrome, that yes, you can feel that through 20, 30 mattresses, you could still pick up that pee right there. So it's the same thing. It's this physical attunement to things that most other people would never even feel or care or be bothered by. So you're absolutely in great company here. I fully understand.
Yeah, another downside. So the way that I conceptualize it, the way I explain it to my students and supervisees is that essentially we have a nervous system that is just much more ready to fire, that it a little bit of sensation is amplified. And there's a spectrum of people, and it makes sense that there would be a spectrum that of genetics that people are born with dispositionally, where some people have neurons that fire very easily and other people have neurons that fire normally and other people have neurons that fire in very not so readily. And there's a lot of pros to that. Like, I think intelligence and deep thinking and the ability to pick up on things that other people don't pick up on, like smells. Like, one of the things that my wife laughs at me is whenever we're in a restaurant and you can barely hear the music, I immediately start talking about the music. If I hate the music, I'm like, oh, why are they playing this kind of dance music? I hate that. And she's like, I don't even hear the music. Or I'll start singing a song and she's like, why are you singing that song? I'm like, well, that's what they're playing. And she's like, I can't even hear them. How do you hear it? Because of all the noise, you know, anyway. So there's some pros, but one of the cons is being overwhelmed by emotions, having perhaps too much empathy at times, picking up on other people too much. But another thing, and you tell me, is this oversensitivity and awareness of your body, which can be a good and a bad thing, that when I feel a sensation in my body, it and it's scary for some reason, I can't stop thinking about it, and then you have increased health anxiety. Is that a thing?
That is a total thing. I think because we can tune into everything, we tune into our own bodies too. So I've often been called a hypochondriac just because I can feel things very quickly, but I've actually asked professionals, I wouldn't fall under that category. But it's actually, for me, it's this ability to tune into my body, to feel things, and it's this awareness of subtleties that goes for your own body as much as it goes for the outer world. So you will find most highly sensitive people are hyper aware of their bodily sensations at all times. That also can be positive. We can get clues about how we feel, how, if we're safe, if we're not safe, if this is a good environment to be in, if somebody else is maybe not a safe person for us. We can feel that in our body even before sometimes our mind can tell us. So it has these positive sides, but it can also sometimes be painful to have a body that is easily aroused. And especially if you want to go sleep, if you want to go rest, sometimes it's hard to create peace and quiet in your body as a highly sensitive person.
Yeah, wow, that's interesting. And for children, sometimes we call them gifted. Is that true?
Yes. Yeah, that's often true. Yeah.
Because they are potentially better at school sometimes at a young age, but they also will struggle sometimes because of being overwhelmed and maybe bored a lot. Tell me about what it's like to be a child in a typical American school being a highly sensitive person. What are the pros and cons there?
I think it depends a lot on the environment of the school and also the teachers, because the teachers are really the ones that will include HSP kids and make them feel like they're normal and okay, or they're the ones that might add to this kind of shaming narrative that the kid who cries more easily or the kid that's more shy or the kid that you know needs downtime more than others is somehow wrong and needs to be kind of normalized and put into the box like all the other kids. And a good teacher will have a deeper understanding of the different natures of their students and cater to that and include them and make them feel like they're okay and they're welcome. Like, I remember when I was in school, I often needed to sit in the library in lunch break because it was too much for me. I couldn't like go to this massive cafeteria and have all these noises and smells and sounds. It's just too much for me. So I needed to retreat. And my teachers made me feel like that's okay. That's a good choice for me. And they didn't make me feel bad for doing that. So teachers can set the tone and the other kids pick up on the tone of the teacher. So if the teacher kind of makes it okay, the kids don't, you know, shame you for that or tease you about it. But I also had teachers that were maybe less attuned to that and less aware. And then the other kids kind of jumped on the same bandwagon and be like, oh, you're strange. Oh, and so HSPs can be the outsiders sometimes. Yeah. So I had both experiences, being the outsider or feeling very accepted and normal.
Yeah, after doing an episode on this, probably like 10 years ago, I'm thinking, we got a lot of emails from people saying as they listened to the episode that they would cry because for the first time in their life, they felt they understood what was different about them and that it wasn't something wrong with them, even though their whole life they've been told that they're overly sensitive, they are picky, they are a bother, they are dramatic, these kinds of things. And what was really happening is that their nervous system was just cranked up to 11.
Yeah. It's like living in Technicolor.
Yeah.
All sorts of things going on all the time. And I think it's understandable sometimes that others don't understand what it would be like to be a highly sensitive person, because it's maybe difficult to imagine what it would be like if you're not an HSP, that this osmosis with life, how that can feel, how overwhelming that can be, and how we then, you know, get on other people's nerves because we say the room is too cold, can you turn down the AC, or the light is too bright or something. They're like, you're so fussy or you're so difficult. But really for us, this is like really, really hugely bothersome things. So it's hard to communicate that and make other people understand it without thinking, oh, you're just quote unquote difficult or hard to be around.
Right. Because for them, they're thinking, well, I don't know, it doesn't bother me, or
it's like no big deal.
Right. Or when something kind of bothers me, I just don't pay attention to it. Why are you focusing on it so much?
Yeah.
How does this relate to autism, according to the research?
Yeah, according to the research, it is not directly linked, actually. So it's of course, many people say it's part of the spectrum, but it's a different category, if you will. So some people will think, oh, it's a continuation of being highly sensitive, but there's still a lot of research going into that. And I think... watch this space. I think there's still more to come in this area, but autism is considered something separate from what HSP is, which is sensory processing sensitivity.
Right. Yeah. According to my understanding of the literature and the brain research, is that for some highly sensitive people, they will be misdiagnosed as being mildly on the spectrum.
Yes.
And for some, it seems like it would be similar, because certainly a lot of people who are autistic will have similar sensitivities to noise and other kinds of things, to be very tuned in on things. But the mistake is that for highly sensitive people, they don't have a whole set of experiences that autistic people will talk about.
That's right.
So it's a different kind of a thing, for sure. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So tell me more about that. So you said DOES does. So tell me more about the deep part. I feel like I didn't really understand that part.
So it's really, let's say you take in some information, you read a book or you watch a movie, and you as an HSP, you would get totally absorbed into that world. Like, this is the typical thing where if you dive into something, it swallows you. And then even after the movie's done, you close the book, whatever it is, it stays with you. It stays in your system. You can't just say, okay, cool, I've seen this movie, let's go for dinner, let's go dancing. You couldn't do that because it's still kind of in you, and you need to process it, and you need to understand it, and you need to reflect on it. So it's like basically when other people already like turn the page, we're still on the page, even though we might have read that page like a week ago, we're still on it.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I'm certainly like that, and people listen to the podcast can attest to that. Sometimes we'll talk about movies or TV shows, and I'm just going on and on and on about all sorts of things. Is this also part of being a nerd? Because, you know, nerds get into things, right? Like, they'll really get into Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones or something.
Yes.
Are HSPs more likely to be nerds?
Oh, that's an interesting one. I haven't heard that before, but I would venture to say that's probably true, because you can get immensely passionate about things. But the depth of processing, the interesting thing here is it's, you can't choose what you process. So it's not just these things that might even be pleasurable to process because you're into it and you love it and you have this kind of nerd-like fascination with something. It can be anything. It can be a comment from your neighbor that you're still ruminating 3 days later. If they misunderstood you or you misunderstood them, and you still have it in the back of your mind, or an email that you know you're supposed to send and you haven't sent it, and it keeps coming, oh, I need to, oh yeah, and what, who, how will I formulate this? And it's kind of, it stays in your system. It's like the I would say, like, non-HSPs have a system, have maybe a system where things fall into bigger buckets and then they can close the bucket. An HSP has multitude of small buckets, and everything needs to be processed intensely before you can close the bucket. So that's where this depth comes from. And it's, I think it's just the way our brain works, and many parts of our processing are not even in our, like, awareness. So often we process things and emotions that we are not, like, cognitively aware of, but we feel maybe tired or exhausted, and we don't even know necessarily why. But it's because we have all of these buckets that are running in the background that are processing stuff from, like, a week ago or 2 weeks ago, and this is where I think we don't have this volition of shutting it down and saying, okay, I don't want to process this thing anymore. Okay, I'm done with this. You can't do that.
Right. Interesting. So before people sort of email in, I just want to address some questions, and maybe you can comment on this too, is that being a highly sensitive person, if we identify someone as such, doesn't encapsulate their entire personality, of course.
That's right.
There are other things. You can be extroverted, you can be introverted, you can be talkative, you could be quiet, you could be shy, you could be outgoing.
That's right.
You could be someone who experienced a lot of trauma growing up, but you could mm-hmm. be someone who has a lot of attachment issues. So having HSP qualities, or what we would characterize as that disposition, doesn't define the whole person. So when we're trying to look at someone and say, that's a highly sensitive person, it's like, well, you have to get to know them a little better, and because they might actually be, they might exhibit highly sensitive person traits because of some other reason. They might be anxious, or they might be traumatized,
yes,
or they might be on the autism spectrum or something. And so it's there's a lot of, you know, nuance there. But I'm pretty convinced, especially when I think about myself and when I hear other people that, you know, speak about, because the thing that really kicks it off to me, or that really convinces me, is that the you know, scratchy clothes and the tags on the, and the, all of that mm-hmm. kind of stuff, because that doesn't seem to relate to all the other things, you know, like, or it very much seems to relate to other things, like the deep thinking, the empathy, the just, you know, sensitivity to things that are going on around you, and the fact that you don't like wool clothing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It really points toward a conceptualization of your nervous system is just overly sensitive.
Yeah.
I was thinking the other day about, okay, if this is a spectrum and some people are on the high spectrum and then we have this, mm-hmm. this normal zone in the middle of the bell mm-hmm. curve, well, we would have, for example, low sensitive people, right? Low,
yes.
you know, low sensitive people. Is there any yeah. research on that?
Yeah, Dr. Elaine Aron has done some research on that, and she has developed a test that you can find on her website, where you can see out of different categories how many apply to you, yes or no. And she's given this test to hundreds and hundreds of people, I believe. And some will come back with, like, they have zero of these traits. So that would be the lowest possible sensitivity, of course. And then people like me who almost have maximum scores in all different categories. So she has looked at that, and I think she didn't do too much research around it, I believe, but she definitely categorized people into more highly sensitive and less or virtually not at all. But, you know, it gets scary when people say they have zero empathy and zero compassion. I mean, this is more your domain. You would know more about that than I do. But I think if people would claim they have, you know, none of these responses, healthy responses to other people, then you might be probably looking at some different psychological profiles.
Yeah, before I forget, where can they find the test? People
It's on Dr. Elaine Aron's website. I believe it's hspperson.com, but I can
hspperson.com. Okay.
I think so. Right. I'm not 100% sure, but if anybody types HSP test on Google, it'll take you there.
Cool. Yeah, there are actually some theories, it's hard to know, that connect what I guess we might characterize as low sensitivity to what we call psychopathy or mm-hmm. what the internet might call sociopathy, antisocial behavior. And in that, when you're, say, 3 years old and you are either within normal range or highly sensitive, one, you notice other people's reactions more easily, you know, or within mm-hmm. normal range. And so you will notice that you did something that displeased them, or you did something that they liked. You pick up on that very quickly as a person when you're highly sensitive. When you're in normal range, you pick on that up on that normally. The other thing that you notice when you're within normal range or high is you notice your own emotional reactivity. You notice mm-hmm. when you're afraid and when you're happy. Well, you could imagine that if someone had very low sensitivity to their own emotions and low sensitivity to other people's reactivity, that they wouldn't notice when they are hurting other people, and that they wouldn't,
right.
and they might not even care. They might not notice. Mm-hmm. They might not
both, no doubt.
Right. And when we don't develop those important connections at the age of 2, 3, 4 years old, fast forward to the age of 40 years old, you might come across as very callous. You might notice that you don't have emotions that are very strong. And so it stands to reason that those things might be connected. Of course, I don't know the research. But the question I have for you is, I was thinking the other day, was when I was growing up, I was a jock. I was a sports guy. People mm-hmm. that knew me as a kid, they knew me as a football player. And that was my primary kind of thing. I played all sports. It dominated my life. And there's a lot of conditioning, a lot of working out. And I hated long distance running. I just hated it. I was in track. I liked 100-yard dashes. Even 400 yards would just drive me nuts. I by the time I got to the 200-yard or 200-meter mark, I was like, oh, I hate it. This is taking so long. And I would have friends that could run marathons and be fine. And I, you know, I was in good shape. It wasn't like I couldn't not do it. I worked out all the time. I you know, I was very strong and, you know, for you know, what I was going through. Anyway, and I started really wondering about my friends who were very good at long distance running. And I would look to them, I was like, what is different about you and me? Like, how do you do that? Because I can't, I could do it because I have the ability to do it. You know, I'm in shape, but I can't mentally stand it. Like, I just can't emotionally cope with even like a 5K. And I came to the conclusion as a kid that because I looked at their general personality and they were all kind of mellow, all those guys, the guys that would run long distance. And they were always just sort of even keeled and weren't very reactive to things in general. And I came to this conclusion that maybe if you're mellow, you don't notice how terrible long distance running is. And if you're highly sensitive, you really notice how terrible long distance running is. I don't know. This just I'm just throwing that out there as a hypothesis. Any ideas about that?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because this falls into what most HSPs would call like the boredom trap. Like HSPs get really easily bored by repetitive things or monotonous things. So this I would think would fall well into that category. And so the difficulty for a highly sensitive person is when there's not a lot of stimuli, bizarrely, because you'd think this is maybe the most relaxing thing for a highly sensitive person. But it also, if we don't get stimuli, then we also feel like something's wrong. Like we want to stay in this osmosis. And so maybe when it gets too monotonous or too repetitive, it gets hard. And that's also why people usually pick like professions that are more creative or that are more, you know, challenging, and they cannot really do the routine office jobs because like a HSP is, they're like, oh my God, I can't do the same thing every day, or I can't, you know, just have this 9 to 5, same thing, same story every day. Like a Groundhog Day scenario is an HSP's nightmare.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I never connected those things, but that is a big theme in my life. Is, you know, the reason why I became a therapist was because I became an adult and started working 9 to 5, 8 to 5, and immediately just could not stand it, you know, working in an office and just doing the same thing every day. I remember just thinking, oh, when's lunch, you know, and just hating it. And I thought, well, maybe being a therapist would be stimulating, and it was, you know, it was mm-hmm. way more interesting and way more challenging and way more chaotic, really. So that's really interesting. Well, so what do you tell, because, you know, for me, I feel like I adjusted to being a highly sensitive person pretty well. I think partly because my parents were good to me and I wasn't traumatized, and I perhaps had the self-esteem to tailor my life towards my highly sensitive nature. When I didn't like something, I felt like I had enough support around me to change my life and to assert my, you know, desires on the world. I feel like a lot of people were raised in a way where they weren't allowed to do that. They were shamed for it, or they felt very much like there was something broken about them. And now they're an adult and they're listening right now. And mm-hmm. how do you help people in those situations?
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the childhood part, because I would say that's the pivotal part in how well an HSP adjusts to life and enjoys life also. So I myself, like you, was very fortunate to grow up with parents who nurtured me and who didn't make me wrong for being different. For example, my brother is not highly sensitive, so they had two very different kids on their hands, and they could differentiate between our needs, and they didn't try to make us the same, and they understood it, even though in those days, you know, there was nobody talking about highly sensitive kids. That wasn't a thing. So my parents just thought that our kid is a bit special. So, but it was okay. It wasn't meant in a way that made me feel wrong. But I know from working with so many HSPs that unfortunately this is the rarity to have a childhood where your sensitivity is honored and treasured. Most of the people I've worked with, they tell me stories of great grief of not being understood, being made wrong, and not just at home, also in school. And always this, like, something is damaged about me. I can't function like other people. And there's this deep, almost societal imprint that says sensitivity is a weakness. And if you are sensitive, then you better fix it, or you mask it, or you pretend you're not sensitive. And this is a coping skill I've seen most HSPs go into, is it's like denial of who you really are and trying to do life like other people. And inside you feel totally lonely, you feel miserable, you don't feel great about life, you don't have any energy, and you withdraw. And this can lead then to a lot of anxiety. And so it's interesting, there is actually research about anxiety in highly sensitive people. Most would think, and it would make sense to assume, a highly sensitive person is automatically more prone to anxiety, but that is actually not true as per the research that has been done. So if a highly sensitive kid had a good, like fairly good, stable childhood, they're actually less likely to develop anxiety than somebody who's not highly sensitive, who had an equally good childhood. But if you had a difficult or traumatic childhood, then the chances of being anxious in later life dramatically increase. And I think what you can do for yourself as a highly sensitive person is really get to know your own needs and don't make yourself wrong for what you discover about yourself. And don't push it down, don't try to be like other people. Really understand your trait and manage yourself accordingly, create an environment where you can thrive. So many sensitives, they start out in a corporate career and it nearly kills them because they cannot function in big offices that are super noisy and bright and sounds and smells, and this is, they go crazy. And then they realize, oh, this, I can't thrive here. But I could maybe thrive as a creative entrepreneur in something. I could maybe do my own business. I could set my own rules. I could get up when I want to. I can have the temperature in the room the way I like it, or whatever it is. So it's about really understanding your trait and then trying over time to create a life where you can thrive with your traits versus feeling held back or pushed down by what you perceive as your maybe awkward difference.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, so helping people to feel entitled, or, you know, a good entitlement to tailoring their life to their own sensitivities and ceasing to shame themselves and try to fit themselves into a box that they will never fit. That's an important part too, for sure. Yeah. Yeah, I remember hearing some research that for people that are highly sensitive, that depending on their childhood, they're much more extreme. So if they're traumatized, they will react much more strongly to that trauma.
That's
and
right.
if they are raised well, then they'll respond much more strongly to being raised well. So it's not that they're more sensitive to trauma, you know, they're more likely to experience the bad effects of development. They're just more exaggerated because they're you know, internalizing what's happening around them at a higher rate, which makes a lot of sense. You know, as you're talking, I'm thinking of other things that for myself, like one of the things that I've often shamed myself a little bit for was at restaurants, I notice the chairs that they will have, and because some restaurants will have cushiony chairs and some restaurants will have just like flat wooden or metal chairs. And I can't stand sitting for a long period of time on a hard metal chair. And I look around restaurants and I just notice everyone else just seems to be fine with it. And I'm like,
yes,
it would have been $20 more to have every chair have, you know, a cushion on it. And I used to do a lot of Yelp reviewing, and I would always review the chairs. I'd be like,
I love that.
The other thing that popped into my mind was when podcasts first started to come out, you know, 10, 15 years ago, I immediately took to it because I could get rid of my boredom. If I was doing the laundry, or if I was mowing the lawn, or if I was standing in line at the grocery store, I now had this solution, which is I could listen to podcasts. Mm-hmm. And then I loved podcasts so much, I started my own 12 years ago. So, and one of the things that people will make fun of me for is I am constantly walking around with headphones because I hate just, I don't even like walking to the mailbox without listening to something. Like I just, you know, and one of the ways that we will shame this is like, well, you're trying to escape. Like you can't cope with just your own thoughts. And I never really thought that that was true because I actually really like my own thoughts in a lot of ways. And that just never felt accurate to me that I was running from something. It was more that I thought, well, if I'm going to walk to the mailbox, I might as well get some education along the way. Yeah, sure. It's only like 3 minutes of education, but that's 3 minutes of education that I wouldn't get otherwise. So I'm gonna listen to podcasts as I go to and from the mailbox. Is that indicative of highly sensitive people?
You know, it makes me smile because I always get told off by all of my family and friends for walking around with headphones absolutely everywhere. And I constantly listen to either podcasts or music. And this is this thing where I said, you know, this ultimate silence, although that would sound like the HSP paradise, it's not really, because we thrive on our processing, on diving deep. And I would even say that this encourages our thinking process. Those that tell us you can't stick with your own thoughts, I would say, no, this is inspires my thoughts. This, you know, when I hear something, can even be music or it could be a podcast or anything, then I start to connect the dots in my head. And they're like, oh, then I have like a parallel conversation going on in my head about, ooh, this could mean this for me. And oh, I can learn this. And oh, look, this is a great insight I can use. So it's not like it stops us from thinking. I would say it deepens our thinking.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, that's one difference about me to people around me is that I am just constantly, and for years, in fact, just to give you a statistic, so my phone app keeps track of how many hours I listen to podcasts, and you can actually look like,
oh,
you
wow.
know, for the year
I didn't even know.
Yeah, for the year of 2019, you know, how many hours, and I figured out, this was a couple years ago when I probably was listening to more podcasts, but probably similar to today, that I spent a third of my life listening to podcasts. So a third of my life I was sleeping, a third of my life I was listening to podcasts. I mean, so that meant that, you know, that was all the little things like going to the mailbox, doing laundry, driving in my car, I don't know, vacuuming or something, because I'm always like, hey, two birds with one stone. I'll vacuum the house and I'll learn a few things. And it amounted to literally a third of my life with headphones on listening to podcasts.
I'm really not surprised, because I've yet to meet an HSP who doesn't enjoy that. I think we enjoy also learning a lot and discovering new things. And most HSPs, and this is anecdotal, but we love processing new information, whatever that new information is. So we like discovering people, we like understanding things, we like going deep into research, theories, whatever it is, or even in music or art or nature. We would love to immerse ourselves and take it all in and discover it, and we enjoy this. I would say this is like the happy place of an HSP, is when they can take in things that they choose, right? This is, I think, a big factor, is that like you choose this source of stimulus for yourself, and then you can enjoy it. I think where you maybe are forced to get stimuli you don't want, that's much tougher. Like, I don't know how you are, but for example, and it's typical for many HSPs, we can't stand watching like super violent movies, or sometimes even watching the news if it's particularly violent. Like this this is painful. Like, this would also be information, but this is something most HSPs will be like, don't show me that, or cover my eyes, tell me when I can look again, kind of thing. I don't know if you have that, but I know I have that and many others.
Yeah,
I know too.
Yeah, a little bit. I think I'm a little more acclimated because of just my preferences for art, but yeah, for sure. I mean, I guess I'll say that I notice when I'm being affected more than other people seem to. And mm-hmm. I also will, and I think older I get, the more kind of sensitive I'm getting. Does it change with age? How does age play into HSP?
I'm not aware of any research about that. I can only share anecdotally what I've witnessed. And I have a personal story because my father is highly sensitive. And so, by the way, for any men listening, it's 50-50, men and women are HSP. And most people somehow think it's a more feminine trait or something, but it's actually 50-50. And so my dad, with time and with age, has become so much more sensitive than he used to be. And it's really, you know, when you love somebody and you know them and you predict their behavior by what you know, and then you see them shifting. And so he's now at a point where he can look at a butterfly and be so moved by the beauty of the butterfly, he will cry and just say, this butterfly is just, it moved me so much, it's so beautiful. And he will hear a song on the radio and he will melt into that song and he will love it. And it's this I don't know if it's age that takes away these filters. Maybe it has to do with masculinity and the filters that are in place there, and maybe now he can just be free to just share his emotions. But yeah, this is the only personal example I have, but he's definitely changed with age.
That's interesting. Yeah, my mom is like that. I wonder if I got it from my mom. That's interesting. What about food and HSP people?
Food. Well, we are considered the picky eaters. And we either have very pronounced taste, like I, for example, I love chilies. I'm German, so, you know, I shouldn't really be loving chilies. I can enjoy very strong sensations, like super spicy or super sweet. I would like that. And bland food bores me. So it's a little bit like with other stimuli, is the blandness is boring and too monotonous, and it's more about the variety and trying different things. And so this is how it is for me in my life. I love food, and I know many HSPs have a very strong connection also to food. Maybe it's also directly related to our bodies. We can feel also how our body responds to what we eat. And we're very, I would say, intuitive eaters, probably. We feel our food and we care about our food.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking for myself, is that compared to other people around me, I am very excited about food.
Yeah.
And my mom is too, when I think about that, I find that other people are just like, yeah, okay, let's eat, you know, let's just have a meal. And
exactly.
Every day for me, it's just like, okay, what is the next meal gonna be? It's gotta be.
What can I discover and eat? Yeah. And you know, this is so true. And another thing, I don't know if you have that too, but because, I have such a strong sensory response to food, I'm always the one my friends ask, is this off? Can you just smell this milk? Is it still okay? Because I can just do like a small, oh no, it's already off. And for them, they couldn't even taste it yet, but I would already taste it. So it's also almost a sensitivity to food. And bizarrely, I even have this thing that when I eat something, I can be like, ooh, it tastes too strong, like a fish that's maybe like a shade, like too old or something, even if it's still okay, I'd be like, it tastes too much like fish now, it's too much. Like this, I can taste things that, again, nobody else could. Like I could smell smoke in a room that, you know, has been aired and, you know, it's a week later. It's the same thing for food.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, the pea and the princess.
Yeah.
Yeah, all these things are sort of coming to mind. Like one of the experiences I had as a therapist was I did some in-home therapy for a while. And some people, my dog is barking if you can hear him, but what I would find is that some people in their houses, they would have their TV on all the time. And as a therapist, I would come into the house and I'd be doing a session and I could not function with the TV on. I just, and I would ask people, could you please turn off your TV? Because I can't, even though I wasn't looking at it, I just sensed that something was happening out of my peripheral vision and I couldn't function. So I'm guessing, you know, that's also, and they didn't seem to be bothered by it at all. It didn't interfere at all with them. You know, it's just kind of interesting. But I have another question, and I don't know if you know the research or have experienced this with people, but what about like, you know, matching up with people? So in a romantic relationship, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So highly sensitive people, there's actually a book, HSP Person in Love, I believe it's also by Dr. Elaine Aron, and it speaks about how highly sensitive people choose their partners. And Dr. Aron recommends, and so do I, that it's actually easier to be with a non-HSP partner because they can kind of protect you and take care of the things that are overwhelming or difficult for a highly sensitive person to do. So often two highly sensitive people don't necessarily attract or go that well together. Or if you get two highly sensitive people that fall in love, you will have one that is more pronounced in their sensitivity and the other that is less so. And I don't know if that's a case of natural opposites attract or just different energies coming together. But I've found in my own relationships over the years that it's been easier to be with non-highly sensitive men for me, but that have a sensitive side to them that is not necessarily HSP, but that have this ability to tune in and understand me enough so that we have a common base, of course. And anecdotally, I would say many HSPs are anxiously attached. So I think this is an interesting thing. And of course, then there's often an attraction between the more avoidant and the anxiously attached. So that's also a pattern that I've seen working with many HSPs and in my own life too.
Interesting. Yeah, tell me about what is your work with people? So you're a coach, right?
Yeah, so basically for me, I only discovered high sensitivity in my mid-20s. I had no idea. I just thought I'm just a bit different than other people. I didn't conceptualize it. I didn't even know it was a thing. And then when I read Elaine Aron's book, I was like, oh my God, there are other people like me. It was a revelation to me to understand that. And I've always been an entrepreneur. And so I had my skincare business at the time. And I thought, this is fascinating. I learned so much about running a business as a sensitive person. And that was overwhelming to me in many ways, because as much as a business affords you this flexibility I mentioned earlier to create your life the way you like it, you can do your Goldilocks business and have it just so for yourself. But it also exposes you to much more pressure than maybe just knowing you have a job and at the end of the day you can go home and that's that. Like, as an entrepreneur, you have to juggle a lot of things and you have to keep a lot of balls in the air. And so what happened, I sold my skincare business and I thought, wow, I learned so much about how to not only survive as an entrepreneur but thrive as an entrepreneur who is highly sensitive. And that's when I decided I wanted to coach highly sensitive entrepreneurs specifically on their journey, because I knew all the highs and lows that come with this trait. And in that context, I decided I want to do a TEDx talk about this. I thought, I want to give sensitivity better PR in the world. So I thought, what could I do? And I had no idea how I would make this happen, but I just thought, you know, maybe an opportunity will present itself. And, you know, sometimes when you set your mind to something, it materializes, and it did. And I thought, you know, I see myself as an ambassador for highly sensitive people. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a researcher. I am a highly sensitive person that has a great interest in the trait, research the trait a lot, and have my own life experience. And as that, I took to the stage. And I kind of hope that people would see it like as just somebody who wants to talk to other people who might feel the same way and normalize this. And if you realize that 20% of the world population is highly sensitive, then I thought, you know, this is something great for us to, you know, connect around. And I don't pretend to know everything about this trait. I'm actually, for a fact, I'm certain I don't, but I just had this passion to connect with others who feel and live like I do, and make them feel like they're valued and they're needed in this world.
Yeah, well, I think you're a fantastic ambassador, the best ambassador I've experienced for HSPs. So
thank you.
I wish you well on your ambassadorship. I think you're spreading the word, and I'm quite positive that a lot of people are quite, I don't know, healed by the notion that there's not something wrong with them and that there is a path forward, which is great. Where can people find you if they want to find you?
They can find me on my website, elenaherdickerhoff.com. So this is horrendously long and difficult. So maybe you can drop it in the show notes or somewhere, but it's essentially my name, elenaherdickerhoff.com. And Kirk, I just wanted to say something about your animals, because I know you love your animals, and so do I. I love animals. And I just wanted to share that there are 100 species that have already been kind of researched that have high sensitive traits. So they have the same about balance, 20% of like some birds, some monkeys, some dogs, some fish have a highly sensitive trait. So you have an equal kind of balancing act in the animal kingdom. And I just thought it's fascinating that this trait is not just a human trait, but that it extends to animals too.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, it makes sense that every species would have a range, and yes, that range would be suited to survival, right? That for koalas, for example, or sloths, perhaps they don't have super high sensitivity. But chihuahuas and lemurs, you know, they're probably just more sensitive to what's hummingbirds or something, more sensitive to what it kind of, you know, it all kind of makes sense that, of course, us as animals would be on some range that was important. You know, you're on the African Serengeti 100,000 years ago, and those people who were too sensitive were reacting too much, and those who weren't sensitive enough weren't reactive enough to their environment. And so, you know, there's sort of a helpful range that every tribe would kind of have a bell curve around that helps the tribe survive. It, you know, makes a lot of sense. It's interesting. Yeah. I'll definitely put your website in the show notes. And thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm glad you're out there spreading the word. It's really great.
Well, thank you, Kirk, so much. And I have to say, it's a huge pleasure for me to connect to you, Kirk. I am no doubt, I mean, many people will claim this, but I will claim myself as your number one fan. I like watch all of your episodes religiously. And you are the podcast that I have in my ears most days. So the hours that I would find in my own counter would mainly be attributed to you.
That's funny. All right, everyone out there, please take care of yourself and take care of others, because we all deserve it. We really, really do.